is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their communities dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
A Packers running back out for Sunday's game. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers play the Bears Sunday at Soldier Field, kickoff at noon. But rookie running back Marshawn Lloyd won't be there. Lloyd had just come off the IR with an ankle injury suffered week two against the Colts. Matt LaFleur on why he was missing today from practice.
Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. Unfortunately, he had appendicitis. So, you know, it's a shame because he's making progress and he'll rebound. I'm confident in that. But it is a shame, certainly.
Is the team excited about running back Marshawn Lloyd? Offensive coordinator Adam Stanovich.
I can't wait to get him back in the fold. And the one game that he played, you just saw his explosive potential.
College football, the Badgers host Oregon tomorrow night, kickoff at 6:30. High school football semifinals, the winners tonight advance to the state title games next week at Camp Randall. Basketball, the Badgers men's team, home tonight against Arizona. The Bucks in Charlotte tomorrow night against the Hornets. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Managing editor of E-Bombs World, Mr. Peter Rapine.
Google this week released a new product, the new AI overview. If you Google search, can I use gasoline to cook spaghetti? Google says, no, you can't use it to cook spaghetti, but you can use gasoline to make spicy spaghetti dishes.
Not recommended. Do not do that.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Looking for the game? Find us over the air for sports coverage on Civic Media stations.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about as we get through the, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. As we get through, it's the end of the world as we know it. As we get through, oh, how could this happen? The hand-wringing, the fear. Look, I've got friends who are calling me saying, are you worried? Yeah, I'm worried for our country. I'm worried that bad people are going to do bad things. I worry that what they have told us repeatedly, what they want to do to name the subgroup, name the other, name the minority, what they want to do, they're going to try. And they're going to be emboldened because Donald Trump has a mandate. And I had a listener who sent me this article from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they quoted a guy from Scranton a former construction worker, 45-year-old guy, said he looked around and, you know, it's poverty all around. It's a Rust Belt city. He said he thought the country needed a change of leadership, but thought, you know, let me just read the Philadelphia Inquirer for you. Wolfson, this is the guy's name, said he didn't love the dictatorial aspect of Trump's personality, but thought it could help the country out of wars and maybe bring peace to some other conflicts, including Ukraine. So a strong man. We need a dictator who's going to go in and break some arms. He said, Wolfson said, he's good and bad. People say he's a dictator. I believe that. I consider him like Hitler. But I voted for the man. So we're literally at the point, or at least with this guy, that you're going to vote for somebody that you believe is Hitler. Because the other side you have been trained, like Pavlovian dogs, to hate. Or because life has gotten so bad that you're just desperate for anything. And I would argue this has everything to do with how bad our corporate-controlled right-wing media has been. How bought and paid for the entire media culture is. This is somebody who's clearly struggling in an area that is clearly struggling. Deindustrialization hit Scranton really hard. All of the negative externalities of that have hit the Scranton area really hard. These are people who are desperate. They're hurting. And they want opportunity. They want the trains to run on time. They want food on the table. And if someone is telling them, hey, we're going to do that, their political positionings don't matter. If they're dictators, doesn't matter. The old idea of if the trains run on time, let the fascists run things. And this is, you know, you go back to what we learned about Nazi Germany. This was that slow walk that saw Hitler's rise. You know, inflation was crazy. Reparations that were have to pay since World War I. That was just causing, just wreaking havoc on the economy. And the people wanted a little prosperity. It's where we are right now. So is it surprising that we are going, as a country, have gone in and elected by a majority now someone that you, with eyes wide open, believe is like Hitler? Are we surprised by this? And the answer is no. Look, I've been saying for, you know, I came up with the idea for this program 20 years ago. Labor Day of 2025 will be our 20th anniversary. But for at least 25 years, I've been saying, look, Democrats have to be better at messaging. Democrats have to build platforms. The left has to build platforms. There has to be something. Working people need to have platforms to counter the corporate message. Because clearly this guy who's voting for someone he believes to be Hitler thinks that Hitler is going to make his life a little bit better. Going to give him an opportunity to make ends meet, to make a better life. Which is really, really sad. But the reality is this is what has happened over the last 40, 50 years. The right invested an enormous amount of money in messaging vehicles to get into working people's ears every minute of every day. And tell a story. Have a narrative. Put first spin on things. The fact that we were sold a bill of goods that, hey, you know, we should let rich people not pay taxes because it's the death tax. Because nobody wants to pay taxes. Everyone's like, no, I don't want to pay taxes. But rich people who have all the money, you go, but, you know, that's beneficial to society as a whole. You know, we use that money to invest in roads and bridges and education and healthcare and all the things that we used to get. But now not so much. The massive redistribution of wealth that's happened in this country, and we've talked about this numerous times over the years, how we've had tax break after tax break after tax break, privatization scheme after privatization scheme, all of this to enrich the wealthy and to hurt people like Matt Wolfson, the 45-year-old former construction worker who voted for someone he believes to be like Hitler. Now, do I blame him entirely? No. We've allowed him to, as a society, we've allowed him and millions of people like him to languish without the kind of support that they need to help. When those jobs went away, what happened? They were left by themselves, left flat. And you have a Republican Party hell-bent on destroying whatever safety net was under their feet. That's the part that's mind-blowing to me. So the question is, what do Democrats, what does the left, what does the labor movement, what do working people need to do? Well, you need to create environments where you're getting good information. I argue this program right here for working people is a must-view, must-listen. Because we look at things from the perspective of someone who goes to work and punches a clock. Because I do that. I have a lot of the same struggles as everyone else. I want the trains to run on time. I want jobs that are going to be able to support a family. I want an education system that's going to educate our kids. I want a healthcare system that isn't killing us or costing us an arm and a leg, or a pay or die system. I want opportunities. And there's a way forward on this. And Democrats have that message. It's just not getting anywhere because they don't have the platforms. They're not talking to Matt Wolfson because there's no way to reach him. And this idea that, well, with our programs, you know, they may reach their voters a handful of times and we reach them just once. No, you're not reaching these people at all. Because we've divided the working class into bits and pieces. You know, when I talk about the working class, I talk about everybody as equal. Nobody's special. Nobody gets to go to the head of the line. We're all equal. Nobody goes to the back of the bus because we're all in the back of the bus. We're all fighting to make ends meet, to have a better life for our children. I have a union contract. My union contract covers everybody. Male, female, gay, straight, white, black, doesn't matter. You do a job, you get a benefit. That's where we should be going, and to protect people like Matt Wolfson. But that message doesn't get there. Doesn't hit the mark. And this is where, again, I hate to say I told you so, but I've been banging this drum for 20 years saying we need to build platforms to reach working people where they are. We need to invest in radio and TV and commentators to tell things from a working class perspective. And if it sounds self-serving, a little bit it is. But at the end of the day, we better figure out how to talk to our brothers and sisters, or we're going to continue to lose them to people who are like Hitler. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So lots of articles being written about just how bad labor unions are going to take it on the chin over the next 4 years. Because look, with the exception of the Teamsters, the firefighters, and the Border Patrol, the rest of the labor movement was unified in their support of Kamala Harris and what the Biden administration had accomplished during the last 4 years. Because, look, they did really good stuff for working people. It makes sense. But now that Trump has won, what's that going to look like over the next year, two, four? What's it mean for federal workers? Trump has said he's going to do this Schedule F thing. Going to fire all these people, going to make patronage great again, which is part of what Project 2025 is all about. Here to share some thoughts on maybe what that's going to look like and prepare us. As I've been saying, look, the solutions are going to be in the suffering. And when the suffering comes, you got to see it so that we can fix it. And that's why I've asked Jackie Simon to come talk with us. Jackie's AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, Director of Public Policy, their website, afge.org. Jackie, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, look, Trump has said, you're going to use Schedule F, going to fire all these federal employees, going to bring in his people, good loyalists, good sycophants, going to make patronage great again. Is this what we're expecting?
Of course. I think we should take him at his word on all of that stuff. I mean, he did it before, so he'll certainly do it again. I think that we're going to see mass outsourcing, privatization, and what remains will be highly politicized, as you say.
Now, you said we saw what he did. What did he do when he was president? How bad was it for your members, for federal employees during his term?
It was really bad. He issued these executive orders that all but took away our ability to represent our members on duty time. And of course, you know, the federal government is a big open shop. And so we have the duty to represent our whole bargaining units, but, you know, people join just because they want to do the right thing. And, you know, we represent around 800,000 people and we have around 300,000 members. So that goes to show you how many people we're obligated to represent on, you know, a fraction, you know, of the dues that we ought to be receiving for that work. And in exchange, we get duty time for shop stewards and local officers and so forth. And he basically took that away. They sort of unilaterally imposed new contracts, but, you know, of course they weren't contracts because they weren't something that, you know, two parties agreed to. They just called it a new collective bargaining agreement that they imposed unilaterally. Took away this time. They took away office space. They took away the ability to be at the work site at all. They were just extremely hostile to the union.
So what you're so we're expecting this again. We're expecting this
absolutely.
On day one.
On
right?
day one. Absolutely on day one we expect that, yes.
And then because look, there's the talk then, this Schedule F thing that they've talked about that I've heard so much about. What is that? So we
right.
know.
Schedule F would be taking jobs right now that are in the so-called competitive service, which you know, most of the jobs in the federal government that you had to compete for to get. And these are, you know, apolitical civil service jobs. They're things like, you know, repairing a tank or being working in the laundry in a VA hospital or being a scientist at EPA or, you know, handling Social Security claims.
So why would we want to put loyalists in those positions? Why would we want to make patronage great again for those jobs? Those sound like just people going to work every day.
Well, we don't want to do that, of course. But the idea of Schedule F would be to take a lot of jobs, and we don't know what number or what portion of the federal workforce would be reclassified into the Schedule F, and those jobs would become at-will jobs. And of course, in that case, you know, you can be fired for any reason or no reason, as we all understand at-will employment. And we would expect people who are known, you know, they've already drawn up enemy lists. They've all already drawn up all kinds of lists of people that they already have shown any kind of reason for the Trump administration to think that the person, you know, doesn't support Donald Trump.
Any disloyalty.
Disloyalty, I guess that's one word for it. And those people are in danger of losing their jobs. I want to really say another thing, though, which is that the scariest thing for me is that if you look at Project 2025, one of the themes of that book that's in many of the chapters is this idea that just go ahead and implement the policy and don't worry about whether it's lawful or not. If you have to defend it in court, you'll do that down the road. In the meantime, get going.
Yep.
And so that's really frightening.
No, and one of the things that's interesting to me, and I had heard this, you know, at breakfast the other morning, where you had a group of people who were gleeful at the suffering that they were going to cause. They were thrilled by the fact that there's going to be a giant bus to pick up immigrants and throw them out of the country in the worst way. They were gleeful of the fact that, you know, they were going to go after these transgender kids and we'll fix them. And they were gleeful at all these different groups. But federal workers seem to have a special place in their heart. They spent a lot of time on that because the right has spent a lot of time demonizing your members and the people who do work for We the People. Why do you think that is? Why do federal workers get this kind of special hatred from the right and people like Trump?
Well, that's a big question that I've spent decades thinking about, actually.
I think
that there's, you know, the abstract bureaucrat, and, you know, I cringe every time I hear the word bureaucrat used because it really has become a four-letter word. And then there are the people that, you know, your neighbor or somebody you go to church with who happens to be a VA nurse or, you know, works on the military base, you know, painting cargo jets, you know, or something. I mean, they know federal employees and they don't think of them that way. But in the abstract, they're an object of hatred and scorn. One answer I can give, I think with the whole, after effect of NAFTA, when so many union members lost their jobs that had good pension plans and health insurance and a certain amount of job security and due process rights and all the things that go with a union contract. When that disappeared for millions of American workers, And then there was also, of course, no prospects that their kids were ever going to have that. They didn't have it anymore, and their kids weren't going to have it, and their grandkids weren't going to have it. But the only people really left, besides, a few, some Teamsters, some auto workers, et cetera, the only people who had that kind of conditions of employment left were public sector employees, teachers, state employees in some places, and of course, federal employees. I mean, we still have good pensions. We still have good health insurance. We still have federal holidays off. We have decent amounts of vacation. All of these things are relics of the era when a large portion of the workforce was organized, and that's when Congress enacted all of these things for federal employees because they had to be able to compete with other union employers. Now, these kinds of things are rare in the private sector. And instead of saying, wait, I want that too for me, that sounds like a good deal, it's resentment and they're lazy and they don't deserve it. And they shouldn't, I don't have it, you shouldn't have it either.
The last vestiges of the American dream is what you're saying. You know, that idea,
I guess,
that one
and
income.
There's some remnants, you know, resentment against people who have it. And I can understand that, of course, but they're getting messages, of course, as you referred to, that federal employees are undeserving and they're lazy and they're.
No, I look at this and, you know, my mind goes, if they've got it, how do I get it? Instead of they've got it, they shouldn't have it because I don't understand that. I don't understand how that works. Because I would like to do better as opposed to making someone else worse to be as miserable as I am. That's where the disconnect for me is. I'm struggling with that.
I think the other thing that can't be ignored is racism. I think that there's a sense that, of course, Fox News tries to exploit that the federal workforce in Washington, D.C. is overwhelmingly Black. And therefore undeserving just because people are Black. They must have gotten their jobs only because they were Black from affirmative action, and they're lazy and they're no good and they're overpaid. And Fox just amplifies those ideas. You know, Washington is not as Black as it once was, but, you know, it used to be called Chocolate City. And people think Washington is filled with Black federal employees who don't deserve to have the jobs they have. I mean, when I say that, I mean racist people.
Sure.
Whose racism is, you know, stoked every day on social media and Fox. No, that's another theory anyway.
No, and it's a good one. It's one I don't disagree with. But you said a lot of this stuff's going to be privatized. And, you know, when you said that, I couldn't help but think about an encounter I had in Wisconsin back when Scott Walker was screwing over public sector workers in that state. There was a gentleman I met at an auto facility because I was getting my oil changed, and so was he. He said he was retiring from a state job that was going to be privatized. He was going to collect his pension because he was getting out in time, and he was going to make double what he was earning at the state job in this privatized gig, because he wasn't going to get health care or pension or anything, but he was going to make more money, and he was going to be able to get the state health care and the state pension that his contract had gotten for him. And it's just one of those things where you go, you're going to earn double doing the same job and probably not do it as well as you did for the state. These privatization schemes, Jackie, none of them have ever seemed to work out the way they're sold. So for me, this sounds more nefarious than just, hey, we want to get more efficient services, we want to get better service. It just sounds to me like they want to destroy the federal government.
Well, they want to destroy the federal government, but it's just another avenue for patronage. They want all these functions of government that are performed on a not-for-profit basis, when they're done in-house, when they go out, when they're outsourced to private contractors, suddenly they're done on a for-profit basis. And they're, as you said, sometimes some of the workers, certainly, you know, the higher level workers and the executives and the management people, make a whole lot more when they're working for a private contractor. But the people on the middle and the bottom are making less. And it's one of the reasons, you know, they always want to try to change the federal pay system, because the federal pay system doesn't have these massive discrepancies between the bottom and the top. It's much more evenly distributed. And when the work goes to the private sector, suddenly you see these big, big salaries paid for by taxpayer dollars.
Of course.
You know, we're talking corporate executive level salaries, and then very low wages at the bottom. So some of the employees of contractors make a whole lot more than they would make doing the same job, basically supervising people doing the government work. They make a lot more when they're working for a contractor, and then the people who do the actual work, often they make less.
More massive redistribution of wealth is what you're telling me. Yes. But I'm looking at Elon Musk as somebody who Trump is going to lean heavily on, supposedly, since, you know, Elon got him elected, spent a lot of money, did a lot of dancing around, doing that goofy jumping he does. Are we concerned about a guy like Elon Musk, who Trump praised for being a cost cutter and someone who fired striking workers? Are we concerned that that Trump has said he's going to bring Elon in because he's the greatest cost cutter ever? Are we concerned about this?
We're very concerned about this. I think that Elon Musk knows absolutely nothing about how government operates. And when I was talking before about operating within the constraints of law and regulation, when you hear Elon Musk talk about what he'd like to do with his cost-cutting commission, almost nothing that he says suggests that he has any knowledge of the law. And so it's, God only knows what he might be able to do if he's empowered by Trump to just start, you know, rampaging through the government.
Well, the reason that Trump likes him so much is you got this dictator mentality, this authoritarian mentality. Rules be damned. The ends justify the means. And if we can go after one of those classes of people and impose our suffering, all the better for it. And look, his base will cheer, sadly. But for me, again, I come back to this statement I keep making. The solutions will be in the suffering, as we see the pain and misery that's going to be inflicted by this administration. And there will be. We've got to stay in tune. We've got to be present. We've got to witness this stuff, and we've got to eventually act. So what are you guys doing to prepare for this as it's coming? Because we know it's coming. What are you preparing to do when it hits?
Well, we've seen this movie before, of course. George W. Bush was a champion privatizer. Bill Clinton was a champion downsizer and privatizer. And Trump was mainly a union buster. He tried to buy it's Veterans Day, so we should certainly mention how zealously the first Trump term pursued privatization of the VA, Veterans Health Care. They'll certainly come back to that with a vengeance. I don't know if they'll try to privatize Social Security, how much of the sort of the work at depots and arsenals in the Department of Defense will get privatized. They've said they'd like to eliminate TSA basically and go back to pre-9/11, rent-a-cops, privatize that in its entirety. You know, so we're preparing for all of that. If we're operating within the law and regulation, we know how to resist that. We know how to challenge that. We know how to fight against that. If we're in a lawless situation, then it's very hard to know what to do.
And again, this is where we the people, other unions, this is where solidarity being a verb and not a noun comes into play, where people really are going to show up and participate. And Jackie, I appreciate you taking a little time for us. I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again and share all of what's coming.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate the time. Jackie Simon, she is the Director of Public Policy there at AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. You can check out their work at afge.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you ready for what's coming? And, you know, do you believe that the solutions will be in the suffering and what we're going to see? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Listen to sports coverage from Mike Clemens on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media is your spot for sports. From updates on your favorite teams, live broadcasts of the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, and Bucks, and local sports coverage in your community, we've got everything you need. Find a station near you at civicmedia.us or download the free app today. We'll have more news and talk coming up here on Civic Media's stream.
Lena Bloom for The Bail Project.
Imagine you're stuck in a jail cell and you can't afford bail, and someone offers you a way out. Just plead guilty and you can go home and kiss your kids goodnight. What do you do? What thousands have. You plead guilty whether you are or not. Cash bail makes poverty a crime. That's why The Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting to end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, lots of email attacking me on the tariff issue. Because evidently the belief that Trump is actually going to be able to put broad-based tariffs on everything coming into the country, and that everything is going to go up by 30 to 40%. I'm a little skeptical. And look, as someone who supports the idea of strategic use of tariffs, this kind of messaging, I'm struggling with. I'm struggling with the idea that we're going to completely close our eyes and ears to using the tool that is a tariff to protect domestic industry, to reshore manufacturing. So I thought, interesting opportunity to reach out to my good friend Scott Paul. He is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Share some thoughts and maybe calm the temperature on the tariff talk and give us some idea of what the future might look like. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you as always.
So I'm sure you're hearing it as well. The hair on fire, the tariffs are coming. 30 to 50%, 60% increase on everything just before Christmas or whenever it's going to happen. Are you concerned that this is going to happen?
Well, I think the answer is it all depends on the details. And we don't know anything
right
about the details yet, about the sequencing, what will be covered, what won't be covered, and all of that. But it's important to know, I guess, right now that, you know, we have tariffs in place, that some of which Trump put in place, some of which Biden put in place on a lot of Chinese products right now, ranging from 25 to 100%. And then there's tariffs on a lot of products that are subject to what are called anti-dumping or countervailing duty orders. And then there are tariffs on steel and aluminum, and probably, I want to say, about 35-40% of all the steel and aluminum coming to the United States has a 25% tariff on it right now too. So we're living with this, and you know, inflation is, that's not what caused inflation. I think this is the important thing to know, okay, is that there were drivers of inflation, certainly in housing, in food and gas, and you can apportion blame for a lot of different things, whiplash, and price gouging, and lots of other things, but tariffs were not the cause of all of that. And I think that's the important thing to know from what we've seen. Now, looking forward, if we get 60% tariffs on more Chinese products, will that have an impact? And the answer is, it depends. You know, we saw, generally speaking, our trade deficit come down, although everybody, all these importers are trying to stock up now, right ahead of the tariff. So that's gonna blow it up a little bit. But we saw generally our trade deficit with China start to come down a little bit, and some companies kind of reconfigured their supply chains to get that production out of China. And the signals have been pretty clear. They were even clear, I think, from the Biden-Harris administration, that if you're in some strategic good, you should be looking at another country to be sourcing that from if you're not going to bring it back to the United States. Now, the broader question, Rick, is like, Trump has also said, we're going to have 10% tariffs. We're going to have it on all imports. And I think at one point he said that might be 20%. And so I think that's the bigger question is, are these going to be on groceries that are seasonal that you can only get from other countries from, you know, during certain seasons? And is that going to hit the pocketbook, right? Or smartphones, another great example where we don't make a single smartphone in this country. Everybody has a smartphone. And so are they going to do that, or are they going to do it in a way that's going to be phased in to give folks a chance to move some production back here? You know, if I were writing it, that's what I would do.
Sure.
I would ratchet them up and say, we expect you to return this production to the United States or one of the allied countries within X amount a year, and we're going to get to that level of tariff. But we'll see. I mean, it depends on, you know, who's operating the trade policy, you know, and as you know, Rick, I mean, the wild card is like, who is the president upset at, right? And how is this going to come down?
Yeah.
And we, you know, unfortunately, there's a little bit of that might be involved with it as well.
Now, also, you know, I think a big part of this is who's going to be the trade representative. I know during Trump's first term, the Bob Lighthizer, who was the trade representative for Trump's term, someone you liked a lot, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, Bob Lighthizer was a, again, let's just set everything else aside, right? And focus on trade. In my opinion, he and Catherine Tai have been by far the two best trade representatives we've ever had in the United States. And he did negotiate USMCA, you know, the new NAFTA with Mexico and also with congressional Democrats. He did find a way to implement the tariffs that were put into place on China and on steel and aluminum. And I thought he did it really, really well. And he's, I think, both feared and respected abroad, which I think is helpful, and you know, is someone who can turn a lot of rhetoric into a policy that makes sense. And he also knows what the stakes are. You know, he used to be a lawyer within the steel industry, and knew what the stakes were. So you know, you got to get it right. You can't set the tariffs too high. You can't set them too low. It's got to be that kind of Goldilocks level to make it work. And he was very sophisticated about that. And the good news is, I think a couple of the folks that they're looking at maybe for trade ambassador worked very closely with Lighthizer and have his point of view about all of this. And so, my hope is that's the direction that the Trump will go on this, and that it will be kind of a deliberative process. But Rick, here's the thing. Yeah, I know Democrats, you know, made a big campaign issue about like how this is going to be a sales tax. And I get that, but no one felt it. You know, I think a lot of people maybe didn't believe it, right? You know, I think that's fair to say. And they do see jobs moving overseas, and that's what they see. And so I think in many cases, a tariff sounds appealing. And frankly, it can work when it's put into place in concert with other policies that are going to drive investment in the United States and lift up workers. And it's when it's done in a deliberate way and not a kind of willy-nilly way. So I think all of that is very, the details matter.
Always. Yeah. It's always the details. But I've had a number of people reach out and say, well, even if they bring manufacturing back, they're not going to be the great jobs they used to be. I go, but they're here. And if you have a lot of them, maybe they become those jobs of the past that used to support a family without a college education. Maybe the people who could actually make things with their hands, maybe once again, they'll be respected in this economy.
Yeah. And I think that's a real part of it, is that there was a clearly, you know, Trump, you know, had some sort of a connection where a lot of working class people at least felt seen.
Right.
Right? And maybe they didn't agree with him, but they felt seen, and they didn't feel like they were being judged. And I do think that a lot of our progressive friends, you know, whether they mean it or not, kind of do that a little bit. Well, just get a college degree, or just move somewhere else, or just do this, or just do that. And it is not, it can't feel good. And so I think that was, you know, I think that's part of what the challenge is here. But the other aspect of this is that people have seen what the job loss does, and they don't like it. They do not like it. And so, you know, those are the issues that you got to lean in on. And so, you know, you saw Biden address it through investing in our country, right? You know, rebuilding our infrastructure, rebuilding the semiconductor industry in the United States, you know, lifting up new forms of energy manufacturing, and also keeping in place the steel tariffs and the other stuff. And for a large part of his presidency, we had manufacturing job growth. And so, you know, my hope is that that's the direction it's going to continue to go, because we have a proof point that this can work. But that's, I mean, I think that's been a real challenge, is trying to move forward these policies that I think make some progressives uneasy, because Trump talks about it too, right? And so you don't want to see, and I think that's not good, right?
Yeah, I mean, this knee-jerk reaction, though, to where we hear something that he says, immediately we have to be against it without thinking about it. And I said from the beginning, I'm not against the use of tariffs in a strategic way to get what we need, which is to maintain some kind of domestic manufacturing base. But when I say this to people, people say, well, they're just going to be low-wage jobs anyway. And you go, yeah, they were always low-wage jobs until they were union jobs. And we can do that again. We did it before. You can do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a wage premium for manufacturing, even non-union manufacturing, over other types of jobs that are common for folks who do not attain a four-year college degree. They're better when they're union jobs, that's for sure. And you can make a, you know, you can make a good income. And look, it's rewarding work. You know, you got to show up every day for the job, and you literally have to show up. There's no virtual work in production manufacturing, but if you can do that and learn a skill, you can have a middle class lifestyle.
Yep.
Right. And so that's what I think a lot of people don't understand, that it is not a dead end. It's actually, there's a lot of ladders up, and there's a lot of factory workers I know who work hard, who are represented by a union, and who are making enough money where they can buy that boat that they want, or they can put their kid, you know, they can help write their ticket, whatever they want to do. And so it's like, you know, I think we have to celebrate that, and also, you know, find opportunities to lean in on trade issues and on the investment. And the biggest mistake that Trump could make, I don't think, honestly, is with tariffs. I think that Lighthizer is not going to allow that, or, you know, the people that worked with Lighthizer. I think the biggest mistake Trump could make is roll back some of the investments that were made in manufacturing, because then you're going to end up with a bunch of like half-built factories in this country that are going to sit vacant. And no one wants to see that.
No, I'm right there with you. I 100% agree. But, you know, let's say that they do put the tariffs in place, because one of the things that was brought up to me is, you know, well, if the tariffs are in place, I'll just go buy everything instead of going to the local store or, you know, anywhere online here. I'll just go to Temu and Shein and all these other direct from China websites. If we're not going to close those loopholes, which we should have done already and should be doing forthright, what's the point of the tariff then?
Yeah, well, the good news is those loopholes are starting to be closed by the Biden administration. The door is still open a little bit, but it's not as open as it was. And I do think that we'll see continued progress on that. We might even see, I'm never optimistic about what can get done in a lame duck congressional session, but this is actually something that I think the speaker has said that he wants to do. And so, you know, my hope is that it does get done, and yeah, that it's not just that people aren't going to be able to skirt this with Shein and Temu. I think I cannot imagine, a Trump administration allowing that to happen. Look, I could be wrong about that, but that seems to me to be, you know, why would you do it in the first place if you're not going to close that loophole?
I got a question for you outside of all this, because, you know, you had mentioned half-built factories, and the Biden administration has put a lot of emphasis on the future of transportation with EVs and battery technology and all of that stuff, and the investments that have gone into those, and there are plants that have been built around the country or are being built as we speak. With Elon Musk, you know, being, you know, Trump's right-hand man, and I would argue the reason that he kind of got over the top, you know, Musk's money and, you know, him buying Twitter, I think had an awful lot to do with it. He's going to want to return on some of that investment. Being the head of Tesla, is it a better thing for him to crush all of that new competition, or is it in his interest to keep moving that forward? I'm curious which way you think, and how do you think he will affect our trade policy and our, you know, our policies going forward?
That's a really good question. And like with everything in his life, he is just a walking, breathing paradox, right? There's just like, on the one hand, Tesla is the biggest player in EVs in the United States, right? Musk has said he sees some of the Chinese EV companies as a threat. At the same time, he wants to do business in China. And so he views the companies as a threat, but he also wants to sell Teslas in China. And in fact, at some point in time, they opened a showroom in the Uyghur region, which was just mind-blowing to me that they would do that. So he's got that, you know, which is just, so I'm not sure where this lands. I mean, can you get inside his mind, Rick? Cause I can't, I haven't figured the dude out yet, but
no, I am predicting though that he won't be around long. I think Trump will tire of him very quickly, because, you know, clearly if you've watched Trump's body language, when he jumps around like an idiot or says some of the things he does, Trump's body language isn't all that positive. So I assume he's going to go under the proverbial bus. Maybe it's an electric bus. I don't know, but I think he's going, I think soon, when he does something Trump doesn't like.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And so, and I also don't know what kind of kleptocracy we're going to see, right? How much he's going to try to capture for Tesla, SpaceX, and everything else at the expense of his rivals. And so all of these are TBD, you know. I mean, Elon Musk is not a friend of working people. We know that for sure. The value of Tesla, the market cap of Tesla, all of that, he does not want to see EV policy like thrown out the window, right? Because that's going to devalue that investment in a huge way, because that's all they make, right? That's all they make. These others, GM, Ford, Stellantis, they also make combustion engine vehicles. Right. And so it's going to be, it's going to be interesting to watch. And, you know, I do think that, you know, there are some possibilities for driving investment into U.S. manufacturing, but I think you got to keep a close eye on what he's up to in China.
Yeah, Musk to me is the most dangerous person in the country, I think, because here's a guy who I think wants to be the first trillionaire. Here's a guy who wants to install a lot of his patronage hires, because a lot of the SpaceX people he wants in key parts of our government. There's a lot of scary stuff there. Look, he can't be president, so this is as close that he's ever going to become, ever come to being a president. So I see some weird things. Last question I've got for you, because I saw an interesting story, had to get your take on. Evidently, the U.S. has ordered this Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation to not sell any more of these advanced chips to Chinese customers. Can we do that?
Yeah, we can, actually. I mean, there are terms both under the CHIPS Act and also under some sanction regimes where we can limit, review, or potentially stop that. And the issue is this, that there's still an insatiable appetite inside China for semiconductor chips, and they can't meet it all domestically. And the better chips come from overseas. Now, one of the things that the Biden administration tried to do was limit the amount of technologically advanced chips that China was able to access. And it was one of the stronger China policies that they put into place. And so TSMC has to watch it, because they also got, you know, major Department of Commerce funding to stand up, you know, factories in the United States, including in Arizona. And so there are some strings attached to that. And we gotta, you know, it shows that industrial policy can be effective, but you also always have to keep an eye on the corporations. And you can't give them a blank check.
There
do have to be consequences.
No, with every carrot should come a stick. I'm glad to see this. But Scott, as always, I appreciate the time. Great work that you guys do over there at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Hope folks will check out the website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott, Paul, thanks so much.
Hey, Rick. Thank you. Great to be on.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think Trump will put the broad-based tariffs? Will there be the Trump tax? I want to hear your thoughts. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1927. That was the day that the Holland Tunnel, connecting New York City and New Jersey, opened for traffic. Before the tunnel, the only way to cross the Hudson River from the city to New Jersey was by ferry. City officials decided to build a tunnel to alleviate congestion. But they had a problem. All those cars driving underground would cause a potentially deadly buildup of carbon monoxide. There had to be a way to ventilate the tunnel. Engineer Clifford Holland came up with the solution. Big fans located at each end of the tunnel could draw fresh air into the passage. The giant fans were nearly as tall as a 10-story building. In honor of his engineering work, the tunnel was named after Holland. But he did not live to see the completion of his vision. The tunnel also owes its existence to unionized labor. The workers who performed the back-breaking work of digging New York's vehicle and subway tunnels called themselves the Sandhogs. In a 1983 book about the union, written by Paul Delaney, a worker recounted his memories of the Holland Project, saying, quote, "The turnover in workers was unbelievable. Men would work an hour or maybe a shift, and they'd never be seen on the job again. Even the strongest men were tired after 15 or 20 minutes in the air. And there was always the worry about being fired. If a man went for more than 2 sips of water during a shift, he was told to collect his wages and go home." 14 workers died on the project. More than a billion cars have made the trip under the Hudson River since it first opened. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So as everyone may know, back in September, my wife was involved in a motorcycle accident. A woman driving a school van made a left-hand turn in front of her and a near fatal accident. And I've talked about a little bit, you know, how fortunate we have been that I'm in the position that we're in financially. We're pretty stable. I've got a good union job that has given me the opportunity to take some time off. I've got excellent health care benefits that I don't have to quite worry about it. That I know that she's going to get the care that she needs when she needs it. I'm very fortunate. I'm privileged in that world. Now I want that privilege for everyone. I want everyone to when bad things happen, have a floor under their feet, have a safety net under them. And this is why I take no joy. Understand, I take no joy. There's no happiness in the story of former New York Congressman Michael Grimm, who you may remember voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The former New York representative who was convicted of tax fraud, who you know went to jail. And I take no joy in the fact that in September, the same month that my wife had her accident, that he was thrown from a horse and paralyzed. He's paralyzed from what they're saying, the chest down. The difference is you know, I'm very fortunate and privileged, as I've said. This guy, a Newsmax host, a host of a right-wing program that you would think, with all the money they've got, you would think would have some kind of insurance for them. But as I'm gathering, there isn't, because they have a GoFundMe account right now that's trying to raise $2.5 million to help him through, I guess, what is a no insurance situation. He's at the same place that Christopher Reeves went after his fall. This is a guy who is an avid polo player, you know, someone who, you know rode horses a lot. But I look at this and I go, here is somebody who said, we're going to destroy what little safety net is there. Here's someone who actively pursued destroying what in this moment could have been, could benefit him. Now, the GoFundMe account, I'm sure, will get him enough money to pay some of his bills. And eventually, if he doesn't have we, the taxpayers, will pick it up. But it got me to thinking about this idea of, you know, what kind of a society do we have, especially as we're going into the Trump years, where you're going to have another push to repeal the Affordable Care Act, another attempt to repeal the dreaded Obamacare. And again, nothing to replace it. Pay or die. I'm sorry, GoFundMe health insurance is not a way to run a country. Now, this is a guy who has significant resources. This is a guy who was a big-time Newsmax television host. This is a guy who was a former member of Congress who's now going and saying, hey, send me money. Now, do I think that he'll get somewhere near the $2.5 million? I don't know. I think this will be one of those, you're a good soldier. You did the right thing by trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Maybe someone will bail him out. Maybe. But it comes back to, what kind of a country do we want? Is it the privileged few? And I got to tell you, I feel enormously privileged to be in the position that I'm in with my wife in the situation she's in. I can't imagine what Mr. Grimm's family is going through, having to worry about, are they going to be able to pay for his care? What is that going to look like down the road? What kind of stresses come out of that? We have a serious healthcare problem, and it's going to get worse under the Trump administration. Bet on that. Know that is going to happen. So like I said, I take no joy in the fact that this guy is in this situation, but it's kind of irony. It's kind of a poetic justice kind of thing. And I wish him well. I hope he walks again. I hope everything good for him. And maybe, I hope an epiphany comes that maybe he's been on the wrong side of this. But we'll see. I want to hear your thoughts. What kind of a country do we want? And do you see that coming out of the Trump era? I'm afraid I don't. I see more pain and misery. I see bad stuff. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, find it out wherever you get your favorite podcasts. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin.